I love this intro.
I always thought they were Australian, but they're not.
No. Want some whiskey in your water, sugar in your tea. What's all this crazy question they're asking me? This is the craziest party that could ever be. Don't turn on the lights, cause I don't want to see. Mama told me let's go. Mama told me let's go.
Choking from the smell of stale perfume. And that cigarette you're smoking, I'll scare you up to death. Open up the window, sucker. Let me catch my breath. Mama told me let's go. Mama told me let's go.
All right, this is not a music show, but man, I like my music, my old music, because there's nothing better. Thursday, February the 5th, 2026. That's Mama Told Me, brackets not to come, close brackets, written by Randy Newman. Wow. And that's Three Dog Night in honor of Chuck Negron, RIP. He died this week. He was out of the band 40 years ago, but it's his vocal that's iconic and a signature of that great sound that came out of Los Angeles, California. Leonard Tell, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I saw them live 3 times.
I knew it. I knew it. I figured this would be perfect to have Lynn comment on this.
And one of their greatest performances was at the Atlantic City Pop Festival in June. I guess it would have either been June or July of 1969, about 3 weeks before Woodstock.
Ah.
And they played at night, and they were fantastic. They people were just dancing in the
you grew the, up when the music was the best.
Yeah, yeah. And Joy to the World that they did, you know. Yeah. Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
Yeah, yeah, that's another beauty.
Yeah, that later became famous in the movie The Big Chill, which
oh,
was a
right.
state
Deborah Winger.
Jeremiah was a bullfrog, was a good mine. I never understood a single word he said, but I helped him a drink.
All right, that's a great one. Yeah.
Yeah, and their biggest hit, well, their original hit was One is the Loneliest Number, which went right to the top of the charts.
Top of the pop.
Yeah. So were they perform? Well, some of these groups now, they're trotting them out.
That you'll ever do. Two can be
a that's a great one. Yeah.
Yeah, great riff. Of course, later in the 70s, they got into a more you know, the 70s were about withdrawing into sort of mysticism and
yeah,
and the Road to Shambhala, I always thought was very much about the 70s.
Road to Shambhala. Yeah, that's a good one.
Wash away my troubles, wash away my pain with the rain and Shambhala.
That's what the 70s was. It was, yeah, washing away all of his sweat and the blood and the
of Vietnam.
The disappointment of the failure of the 1960s. What should have happened was a thoroughgoing revolution, especially by 1975-76, post-Watergate, the disgraceful departure from Vietnam, but none of that happened.
Mm-hmm. The revolution was delayed or put on?
It had always been co-opted from the beginning. It was never really our revolution. We only thought it was. And of course, the drugs really contributed heavily to that. A lot of the best people just, they burned out.
Well, that was the lead singer, Chuck Negron. He was kicked out of the band. He wouldn't get off drugs.
I wasn't quite aware of that.
Yeah, that's what it says here.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, he was kicked out when he was 45. He died at 83. And he's been out of the band since the 70s.
So were they still performing as late as...
Oh, they're still going now.
Oh, but they're not the same personnel. I mean...
No, the past members, if you see here, is a list as long as your arm. Actually, the only the founding member is still there, Danny Hutton. And he's in his 80s, for goodness sake. Let's just click on his name.
Yeah, I don't...
He was born in 1942. Here he is. He was performing near you in Annapolis in 2024.
Yeah, that probably would have been at the Ram's Head Tavern. Ram's Head, the Ram's Head probably in Annapolis, which features a lot of these revivals. But I don't know. I don't like it when, I mean, we were talking about how pathetic David Lee Roth sounded.
Yeah.
Or Ozzy Osbourne at the end, you know.
Yeah, you got to give it up. You got to know when to quit, but I guess they need the money or they can't, they just can't stop being nostalgic. It's amazing.
Yeah, you know, and, or in the case of a group like Journey.
Yeah, they just get a new singer.
They had to replace the lead singer who really defined their sound, although their new singer is also very good. So, but
I know you like always, you always like to test me. What is Three Dog Night?
Oh, yeah, well. That's why I thought they were from Australia, because it's right. It's supposedly an expression from the Aboriginal language that describes a particularly cold night where sleeping with one dog or two dogs isn't enough. You need the warmth of three dogs to keep from freezing to death out there in the desert or wherever these Aborigines were living. And that's why I always thought they were Australian, but they're not. They were from California, so you saw how.
Musician Van Dyke Parks, an arranger at Warner Brothers, disputed the above story and said he coined the name. He wrote on Twitter, "I was nuts about Hutton's girlfriend, quite a dancer, yet she didn't read Mankind magazine, nor have an inkling of anthropology. And the cold Aboriginal nights that inspired my suggestion."
Well, was he from Australia?
Let's see. No, he's from Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Well, one Australian group I should mention, because I keep going back to their music, and they were as big as Peter, Paul, and Mary, The Seekers, and especially their lead singer. Oh, her name escapes me now, but your Australian listeners will know right away. They did a lot of songs that were big hits and had a very distinctive sound, you know. So Walk Right In, Sit Right Down.
Who is it? The Seekers?
The Seekers. Come on. You're not that old. That's right. You're younger. You wouldn't remember them because they were from the early to mid 60s. Judith, what's her name? The Seekers. Anyway.
Hold on. Let's listen. I might know the song.
There's a new world somewhere they call the promised land.
Okay, here's their biggest hit.
And I'll be there somewhere to hold your hand.
Hey there,
oh yeah, that was the theme to a hit movie.
I know that one.
With Lynn Redgrave and James Mason, yeah.
I know that one.
So yeah, they had a lot of hits and
Australian folk pop and gospel. Formed in Melbourne in 1962.
The lead singer's name, Judith, what's her
name? Judith Durham.
Durham. Right. Australian listeners will know.
She's still going, 1979. Or sorry, she's age 79, rather. She's still going. No, she died. Never mind.
I think I remember there being a tribute to her at one point. But yeah, this was very original. I mean, this was great music. The vocals had to be perfect. They were often, like with the Seekers, those were acoustic instruments, like a guitar. And this, they really came out of a period we called folk music,
right?
And then folk music became folk rock with the Byrds. They were the first one to take Pete Seeger's songs and put them to using a rock and roll ensemble with an electric guitar, 12-string guitar, and all that. So, but for a long time, I would say from about 1958, 59, right on up to about 66, 67, there were shows on television like Hootenanny and Shindig.
Yeah.
And of course, Bob Dylan was huge at the time. And then in everybody's mind, he sold out when he appeared at the Newport Jazz Festival with a band behind him. And people thought it was a total sellout. But yeah, because originally it was just him, his guitar, and his harmonica. And Peter, Paul, and Mary, they were huge. And one of them, I believe, ended up getting involved in a PDF file scandal. So that's another.
Oh, PDF file. That's funny.
Yeah, and they were not generally nice people. Mm-hmm. I knew some individuals who were active in the Catholic Youth Organization, which apparently sponsored events for Peter, Paul, and Mary performed. And this guy told me they really treated the kids like crap. They wouldn't sign autographs. They just had a bad attitude. So I don't know. Look, don't expect character from artists.
Yeah.
Artists may or may not have character. More often than not, they have severe character defects. Edgar Allan Poe, he was addicted to laudanum, which is opium, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I don't need to go through all the rock and roll heroes that have gone down the path of drugs or other things. So never conflate the artist with character. The most striking example of this to me, because I'm thinking now of the flap around Roman Polanski.
Okay.
Highly successful director. Did some very good satires. The Fearless Vampire Killers with Sharon Tate. Does anybody remember Sharon Tate?
Yeah.
That's the Manson narrative.
Yeah.
But Polanski, and he did Rosemary's Baby, which was very big. Well, he got into trouble. He really was caught.
By the way, would you recommend that movie, Rosemary's Baby?
As a period piece to understand the mindset of the late 1960s, yes.
Okay, but as a movie, is it any good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a decent. The best performance in it is not by Mia Farrow, who kind of gets on your nerves after a while. Mia Farrow gets on your nerves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Woody Allen films, I don't know. After a while, she gets on my nerves. John Cassavetes plays her husband in that. And he really steals the show for me because all the time he's secretly collaborating with these Satanists to use his wife as, well, I don't want to do a plot spoiler.
Okay.
Watch the movie. Yes, I think Roman Polanski made great movies. It's unfortunate he got involved with underage girls and got arrested for it. He was not trafficking, as we're told was the case with the Maxwell Epstein group.
Yeah.
But
he was just hanging out with them?
Well, you know, it was the nature of the time. Like, you know, Ted Nugent's another one. You know, Ted Nugent gets all up in your face. He's so self-righteous. But he used to boast about boffing 15-year-olds. Groupies when he was, you know, at the height of his popularity. Then all of a sudden he became this super conservative guy. But that was the scene in rock and roll. I mean, anything, free love. And that really didn't make distinctions based on age. So there was a lot of technically what you would call statutory rape going on. Not without consent usually, but can a 14 or 15 or 16-year-old really consent? So, but here's the lesson about Roman Polanski. And what am I comparing him to? I'm comparing him to somebody else who they're going to defend no matter what. Oh, Everyone came to everybody loved Roman Polanski. He must have been very easy to work with as a director. Meryl Streep, in particular, came out in defense of Polanski because he was hiding out in Europe in order to escape trial for statutory rape of underage girl.
He went to France.
He went to France. And Hollywood just rallied behind him, like with Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Kind of like with Woody Allen, there was kind of a split. Some people turned against him. But I'm trying to think, who's the other? Well, the excuses that people make for Donald Trump, or the whole dialogue around this Epstein thing, where you can some of the emails that have been coming out, there's just a treasure trove of email material, including correspondence between Noam Chomsky and Epstein. It turns out that Zoran Mamdani, the new mayor of New York, his mother, a filmmaker, very prosperous filmmaker, she also hung out with Epstein.
Time, 17 seconds.
So, people jump to defend Roman Polanski and make all kinds of excuses for his having committed a crime. And this is how Hollywood and the cultural elite, especially on the Upper East Side of New York, they always circle the wagons.
Yeah.
They protect their own no matter what. And I think that's what was going on with Epstein. I think that a lot of this stuff was happening, but they don't really feel it's necessarily wrong. So we have Noam Chomsky actually giving advice to Epstein on how to confront the charges that he was running a human trafficking ring with underage girls. And that's the most amazing thing of the Epstein thing. Even after he confessed and pled guilty in 2008, you really don't even need to, everyone's looking at his connections with Bear Stearns, BCCI, all these other business connections that go all the way back to the 80s. In the 90s, including Iran-Contra. But really, for me, the object here is why, after his conviction, which everyone must have known was a sweetheart deal, based on how serious the charges were, and was highly unusual, because I think it's the only time, a very rare occasion, where the terms of a plea bargain involve protecting the network, protecting not naming any or indicting any other co-conspirators. That's why Maxwell wasn't arrested and charged at the time, or Les Wexner or Jean Lebrunel, because Epstein fled to Israel. He fled to Israel facing these charges, as is very common for convicted felons or indicted felons here in the United States. Instead of facing trial, if they can prove they're Jewish, they can run off to Israel. That's what Epstein did. He only came back because of the promise of this particular plea bargain that was negotiated by Alex Acosta. So anyway, Roman Polanski, to me, if you want to understand things like Woody Allen, or Epstein for that matter, that this sort of almost cavalier attitude that cultural elites, and especially Hollywood and New York, have toward these things, they say, everybody was kind of wild in the 60s and 70s. Well, so what? So he slept with a 15 or a 14-year-old. So what? And yeah, go back and look at all the celebrities that rallied around Roman Polanski to defend him in this situation. And you'll get an understanding of the gap that separates us from them. And F. Scott Fitzgerald was absolutely right when he said, the rich are different than you and me. They're a different species. They've been brought up under completely different rules, and they don't look at right and wrong the same way we do. They're very, very cynical, very jaded.
Hey, Lynn, we got a caller in her. Caller in her, where are you calling from? What's your name?
This is Willard from Florida.
Hey, Willard from Florida. How you doing? How's the weather down there?
Oh, don't like it.
Uh-oh. Well, we're exporting it down south. Yeah, I got your email, and were you trying to call in that day?
Is that with Tim?
Yeah, I didn't see you call.
Yeah, because I didn't want to interrupt the flow. You guys were really doing, you know, on a good roll, on a good topic, and I didn't want to interrupt, so I didn't call in.
Okay, you could have called in, but that's okay.
Okay, I'll get them next time.
By the way, go ahead. What's happening now? What do you got?
Well, I wasn't going to call him, but actually we brought up Polanski. Well, Polanski was charged with knocking out a 13-year-old Quaaludes. So that's not free swinging stuff. That's evil. Taking Quaaludes and knocking out 13-year-olds. And I don't recommend looking into Polanski, but if you do, it goes south from there. You know, he's not a normal person. Because 13 for him in several cases is too old. And guys like that need to be called what they are, which is evil. They need to be stigmatized. Yeah, he makes great movies, but, you know, that's too high of a price for me to pay for that. And Rosemary's Baby is important in that you get to see how these operations work, because you could overlap RFK and Manson and the Beatles with the group that's with Rosemary's Baby. They're all connected. And people ascribe it to coincidence, but I would argue, no, they're part of an intelligence operation. That's why they're all connected. But I don't know, Lynn, if you wanted to respond to that.
Lynn, you want to respond to that? I think Lynn fell asleep.
Oh, okay. Well, Polanski goes into detail about his preferences in his biography and elsewhere. I don't want to really go, you know, go in that direction. I wanted to ask her, on Facebook, she posts about Epstein. Is that because she believes he's all this stuff is real about him, or because it's fake?
Lynn, are you there?
Yeah. What's the who's posting? Me?
I see a lot of posting on Facebook page about Epstein.
I know what you're saying is posting on Facebook.
I see you reposting information about Epstein.
Oh, yeah. Everything that Thomas Massie says, I repost.
And what's
because
he saying?
I think
saying?
He's sincere. I think he's honest. And, yeah, I want it all. Now, I know they're going to put out a lot of – what they're doing is they're trying to lower the signal-to-noise ratio by putting a lot of noise out there. But here's the thing. I look at a guy like Roman Polanski and I say, wow, he's probably, he's connected to the Manson thing, because Sharon Tate was, I guess, about the most high profile character in the Manson murder, bloody murder narrative, along with Lino and Rosemary LaBianca, the bodies and all that. And it leads me to wonder if Roman Polanski wasn't, in fact, also being blackmailed by the intelligence cartel to go along with the Manson narrative. Now, what happened to Sharon Tate? I don't know. I mean, they're claiming that the basic narrative says that she was murdered by the Manson cult followers, and her baby died with her. She was pregnant at the time, I think. But to me, it's certainly no accident that Roman Polanski, who was already probably in trouble for what you describe as abuse of, and as I say, giving him a Quaalude to knock him out, well, Bill Cosby would get up on stage and boast about that. He'd make jokes about that, remember? At what, in the 80s?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So it's kind of, there's a misogynistic element to it as well. But when you see how all these people are tied together, you realize how easy it is to blackmail them. And that's what I think happened with Polanski. That otherwise, he was a Hollywood filmmaker. He was a top director. He could have called out the Manson thing as fake. But he would never do that, even from his refuge over in Europe. In exile, he would never do that.
What, you remember in the movie how the girl commits suicide and lands on a beetle and there's blood on the beetle?
You're talking about Rosemary's Baby. Which?
Beginning at the entrance to the Dakota where John Lennon was shot.
Oh, yeah.
So you see, it plays out like a story because you got John Lennon assassinated at the Dakota, and the Dakota was made famous by Polanski. And when you watch the movie, they have the Beatles bloody right where Lennon got allegedly shot. And once you start going into layers, it's all connected. And I don't think it's blackmail at all. It's just a part of the script, a job he was given to do with these different people. You know, allegedly, wasn't he with RFK the night
before? Are you talking about Mark Date? Oh, Roman Polanski?
Yeah, Polanski and Tate. We're with RFK the night before.
Yeah, the Hollywood elites got behind RFK Sr. Yeah, they did. No doubt about it.
Yeah, there's different elites, but these are a small group where Manson says the Beatles told me to do it, and it's connected to the cult.
Right, like IPS is pretty well convinced that, I guess, John Frankenheimer, the guy who directed the Manchurian Candidate, drove RFK Sr. to the Ambassador Hotel to the site of his alleged assassination.
Right.
So IPS is contending that, in fact, Frankenheimer probably scripted and directed the whole thing. So the one I will never forget is Roosevelt Greer, who had been an NFL superstar, who was also campaigning for Bobby and was right there kneeling over his body on the floor. And they may have conducted such a convincing bloody psyop that Roosevelt Greer himself was convinced it was real. That's very possible. Not everybody has to be in on it.
No, because, I mean, he was there with Plimpton, these guys, and all you need to do is to shoot off a couple of blanks and have some crisis actors yell, "I saw blood," you know, they're all dead.
Right.
And not again, not again, and people are going to freak out. Go ahead.
I've got a whole thread here in the forum, which I'm sharing on screen right now.
Yeah,
called Casualties of Hyper-Realistic Paintball Drills. I guess last week I showed you the kid whose eye was allegedly lost an eye because an ICE agent hit him in the eye with something, maybe a paintball, could have done it. But
are you gonna you also put the video of the guy, how easy it is to remove that taillight?
Oh, I'm really getting into it on Facebook, arguing with people about this.
Oh, okay. Someone put that comment in the link in reply to last week's show. They said it's very easy to do.
I don't not with one kick, and not intact, intact. Okay. Listen to what some of these other people say. Right here, because I went to a video, an instructional video on how to remove the tail light. And one person says the entire tail light assembly is different, by the way, being faked out there, that the wire is too short.
Ah, interesting.
Because it's out hanging by a wire. And even more,
this assembly is totally different.
Right. And here's somebody who said, implausible. I just hit a deer at 40 miles per hour the other day, and the lens broke off my headlamp. So the headlamp didn't just pop out like a cartoon. Let's take a look.
Oh, I get you. So yeah, you're saying that's a Hollywood prop.
Right. Or they've asked the AI to do something. Yeah, I didn't really.
I'm going with Hollywood prop.
Seconds.
But here it is, you can judge for yours. I've got a whole write up here.
Wow, you really went to town. Way to go.
Oh yeah, on the assembly, on the material. It's since the 2018 model year, the Ford Expedition has been constructed with a high strength military grade aluminum alloy body.
Military grade.
You watch the event itself. Watch the event itself and tell me.
This is a moment the news movement filmed on January 13th in Minneapolis, showing a man who appears to be Alex Preddy interacting with federal immigration agents.
Okay, so that was the first kick. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
And the light is still working because it was blinking. Now watch. Yeah. I'm going to slow this down if I can. Oh, it doesn't have. Here we go. Playback speed. I'm going to slow it down.
Wow, you're really going to slow it down. Okay.
7 days before board.
Okay, there's a strike. Oh, boy. It just. I can't believe it.
It's totally blocked out.
Yeah. Why did it do that?
Well, deliberate, I guess. They don't want you to see what happened.
Try it again.
No, just keep playing it. Oh, did it stop? By the way, we got another caller in. Our caller in, where are you calling from? What's your name?
Hey, fakeologist. Hey, Lynn. It's Jay from Texas. How y'all doing tonight?
It wasn't even a good kick. Look, guys, I know kicks.
I know. You're the kick.
Yeah.
The kicking
expert. I would have done a side kick against the body of the vehicle to do that. He didn't even throw a decent round kick. He threw a sloppy crescent kick. And watch. Uh-uh. No way. No
way. Just refresh it. Jay, what's your question?
I have like two questions, but yeah, you're right. The reason why it doesn't look real is because the ice thing, I believe what Phil says, it's just to make us hate. Like, I mean, he says white people. I just think American because of
shot the and killed.
People not even what you would think would be Caucasian, and how Phil says it's just a production to make.
Well, yeah, but I guess when I say forensics, okay, there's his first kick. It didn't do anything. Now, yeah, there's his first kick. And there's his second kick. Would the thing pop out intact? He smashed an aluminum body. Now, watch. So, okay, we can argue about whether this is physically possible or not. I don't think it is with one kick. But think about this. Here the ICE agent comes out, wrestles him to the ground.
Yeah.
And this is ISIS X. Now, look, if you or I did that, where do you think we'd be?
Jail.
Damn right. But listen to the official narrative. And this is where I say that if you don't want to deal with the forensics of what the physically impossible, which is the kick, in my opinion. Wow, I wonder what won't let me go back from this. Yeah, it doesn't like it. The screen sharing is really clumsy. I got to stop sharing and then share again.
All right. We get the idea. Why don't you talk to Jay?
Well, I want to talk about the narrative because.
I know, but Jay has a question.
Because we'd have been arrested. But I want you to hear.
Because it would have been destruction of government property. You're right.
This happened.
And, federal agent.
Exactly. And the thing is, they just released this after he was killed. A couple of days after he was allegedly killed, then said this happened 11 days before the event. Well, what a coincidence. What a coincidence. The guy destroyed federal property. He destroyed federal property. It's on video. They have all the evidence in the world. Even if they didn't arrest him right then and there, which they could easily have done, all they got to do is send a copy of that video to the Minnesota State Police and say, hey, this is destruction of federal property. You got to arrest this guy. He violated Minnesota law. But the excuse we were given, which this screen share will not let me go back to, so I'm going to have to work my way back to it. From here. Oh boy, why do they do that?
But they're fighting fire with fire, right? They're trying to use, like, one side is saying the ICE isn't supposed to be there constitutionally, and then the other one side is saying we can do whatever we want to. Well, not like we could try to
I'm sharing a screen right now, Fakeologist. Would you like me, let me share the screen?
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Because so people understand what I'm talking about here. There's the instructions on. Yeah, it, steel screws hold that taillight in.
Okay.
Oh boy, it won't let me go to the forum. It won't let me go to the forum. I'll try again.
Willard, did you have anything else to
ask? Here we go. Here we go. Here's the narrative. Just listen to the narrative.
Okay.
You know what it reminds me of? Kicking that car reminds me of this.
Right. Flight 175.
Right. The same thing. Same thing.
Right.
On January 13th, the news movement filmed a man who appears to be Alex Pretty interacting with federal immigration agents. Our footage was analyzed by the BBC, whose facial recognition technology confirmed his identity to a 97% degree of accuracy. Of course, that doesn't mean it wasn't fake. They could have inserted his face in CGI. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
We were filming a documentary about ICE activity in Minneapolis when we received a tip.
Ah, like the Nade brothers.
Yeah, that federal agents recaptured this footage, blah, blah, blah. Yes, Alex Pretty was captured on video kicking out a taillight and spitting toward a federal vehicle in Minneapolis on January 13th, 2026, 11 days before he was in another confrontation in which we were told he was shot.
There's the 11.
Detailed reports from the incident include property damage. Video evidence shows Pretty kicking a dark Ford Expedition used by federal agents twice, shattering the passenger side taillight. That's not true. That's not true. The taillight does not shatter. It pops out of the whole entire assembly, right. Pops out of the body of the SUV, lands on the ground, hanging by wires, completely intact. So AI is bullshitting you there. He shattered the body. You can see the crack in the body of that Ford Expedition Explorer. Look at that again.
You have the number code there too, from the license plate to the days it was released. I mean,
look at that.
Well, you could
look
tell.
At that.
Yeah, we've seen.
You
that.
Really be able to crack the aluminum like that? So, let's continue with the narrative. Oh, here we go. Conduct. He was seen shouting expletives, making obscene gestures, and blah, blah, blah. The confrontation. Following the damage, federal agents emerged from the vehicle and tackled Pretty to the ground. We see that on the video. He was eventually released or broke free and was not taken into custody at that time. Context. This encounter occurred 11 days before Pretty was fatally shot by different federal agents during another protest in Minneapolis on January 24th. Well, that would give really paranoid people the idea that they set him up and murdered him in revenge for this. Verification, a representative for Pretty's family, well, those are the crisis actors, and their attorney confirmed that the man in the video is indeed Alex Pretty, blah, blah, blah. So here's my question, guys. Am I asking the wrong question? You're not sharing my screen anymore, are you? Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, we got it, Lynn. Don't worry.
Here's my question. If Alex Pretty kicked out the taillight of an ICE vehicle in Minneapolis, an expensive vehicle, on January 13th and spit on the vehicle, then why wasn't he arrested? Because you and I would be arrested. Alex Pretty was briefly detained, but not formally arrested or charged following the January 13th incident in Minneapolis for several reasons identified in investigative reports and witness accounts. Tactical withdrawal. After federal agents tackled Pretty to the ground, they encountered a screaming crowd and chose to deploy tear gas canisters and withdraw gutlessly, rather than escalate the confrontation or finalize an arrest. Brief detention. News footage from the news movement. I don't know who the news movement is, but they're highly suspect. They're the source of this video. Shows that while agents forcefully took Preddy to the ground, he was allowed to scurry away or broke free as the agents retreated to their vehicle and drove off. Policy and documentation. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, initially stated they had no record of the incident when video first emerged. So they tried to lie to cover up, suggesting that agents may not have filed formal paperwork at the time of the encounter. Now, listen to what I'm saying. Even if they decided not, they could have arrested him right then and there and hauled him off for vandalism, destruction of property, assault, whatever. But even if they didn't arrest him there, they could have simply sent that video over to the Minnesota State Police and say, we got property damage here. You got to criminally charge this guy. But internal guidance reportedly instructed ICE officers in Minnesota to avoid engaging with agitators and to focus only on individuals with criminal histories, which Preddy, a VA nurse with no prior record, did not have. So what they're saying is, well, this guy may have done $1,000 worth of damage to a federal vehicle, but it's not really a crime. Former U.S. Attorney John Fishwick noted that although agents had probable cause to charge him with assaulting a federal officer and destruction of property, they opted to leave the scene instead. So what am I getting at here? He could have been arrested at any time. Look, first of all, no, I don't think that the latest Ford Expedition is made of cardboard, but that video sure makes it look like it. But even if he did really, even he was Superman with a Superman kick, more powerful than Bill Wallace, you know, he would have been arrested. They had 11 days to have this guy arrested before they encountered him again and allegedly shot him to death. So I don't even buy the basic narrative. I say it's full of shit.
Yeah, it's part of the script because that's why it's like one of those plot twists where they keep somebody alive and then when they get rid of him, they're like, why did you kill him? And then suddenly this video pops out.
Yeah, exactly.
That video. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
why?
Video, it's 11 days and then you have the license plate, which is just like the number 13 added up.
Right. He was allegedly shot on the 26th, but we didn't see that earlier video from 11 days earlier till like maybe 4 or 5 days after, like, you know, about a week. So what, were they sitting on it or did they create it? Did they fabricate it?
Probably fabrication. I mean, from what came out in the Epstein files, it looks like he's created a lot of stuff by working with them, because isn't a lot of the ICE people, at least this is what the news media said, it's a bunch of like Proud Boys and basically people from online forums. And if that's the case, then why wouldn't they be tied in with like actors and actresses and government agents? Like you said about Nick Fuentes, he's selling Jeffrey Epstein sweaters. And he's just so in your face, like when you get down to like all these like popular online media personalities, no matter what side they're on, it just seems like they know what we're talking about and they're throwing, you just see like their merchandise is just throwing in our face. Like, because I don't know if you remember, you were talking about Charles Manson and there was little groups of killers. Do you know the West Memphis Three? Lynn, do you remember that story?
I know about him, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of stuff is like with the file. It goes back to like Iran-Contra and what's that? Boys Town in, it was in Nebraska, you know, 1980s with politicians too. Yeah. That, I don't know. It seems like, because you know, Johnny Depp was in that trial defending those West Memphis Three.
Right.
Weird stuff. Just like he just popped
yeah, the West Memphis Three. Okay, that supposedly was a satanic killing, and they claimed the boys were framed, right?
Yeah, they said, oh, it's all made up, and the media is just going crazy with the speculation and stuff like that. I forget the word for it, like out there speculation, but yeah.
The West Memphis Three, if you look into it, there's three teenagers, and they really did kill those three boys. Now, once you look at these celebrities and guys like John Douglas from the FBI and find out how they got him out of jail, that's where the trouble starts, because they really did kill those boys. So how is it Hollywood and John Douglas from the FBI gets him out?
Yeah, right? Even the father said that that they killed him, and then his story changed. He was like, oh, no, I was...
No, that's a stepfather Byers. If people look into the story and find out what happened, you know, they really did kill him. The Hollywood movie maker came in from HBO and made a documentary. And it's kind of like this Innocent Project stuff where you got these falsely incarcerated people and we're going to free them. But when you get past the flash of HBO documentaries and the celebrities, you know, you find out that, you know, those boys really did get killed. It wasn't so much a satanic crime. That's kind of overstating it. You know, the guy was unstable. Echols was unstable. He had been committed in a mental hospital, and his parents were afraid of him because he was violent, you know. And then to prove that he wasn't into witchcraft and the occult, when he got out of prison, he went and moved to Salem, Massachusetts. It doesn't get more in your face than that.
Yeah, but what you're looking at.
Then I wanted to ask you about the Epstein question I had. Okay, if this case is real, why, like in the recent evidence dump they had where he was in a cabin in Canada and in France, these pictures look artificial, like AI generated, and some of them look posed. So why are they generating these false images to put in the media if this stuff is supposed to be real?
Well, I'm currently featuring, if you share the screen.
Yeah, it's on there.
Right. I'm giving you a reason why, because.
Okay. Oh, I can't see the screen. I'm just on my phone, so fill me in.
Well, it's a piece on the school books that you had when you were in elementary school and middle school and probably high school. Because Robert Maxwell, the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, owned McGraw-Hill and the other companies that produce these textbooks. There they are. There's some right there.
Wow.
Winning Hearts and Minds. So are these people insignificant? Are they just actors? No, they're a little more than actors, because they supply us with our textbooks. Robert Maxwell, an Israeli Mossad agent, who allegedly died by falling off his yacht, an agent for the Rothschilds. And by the way, Epstein told, who was it? One of the email conversations has Epstein telling Ehud Barak or somebody that he represents the Rothschilds.
Oh, brother.
An agent for the Rothschilds purchased Robert Maxwell. Of course, he was a publishing giant. He was as big as Rupert Murdoch, maybe even bigger in terms of Australia and London tabloids. The reason why we're more familiar with Rupert Murdoch is Rupert Murdoch came here, got an American citizenship, and bought up a whole bunch of media, Fox and everything else. But Robert Maxwell was really bigger than Rupert Murdoch in the publishing business at one point. And yeah, he purchased McGraw-Hill textbooks in 1989, the second largest textbook publisher in the United States at the time. So why was an Israeli Mossad agent controlling these textbooks?
The same reason that
Ghislaine is part of that. That's right. Who her pops was. Show that.
Turns out that the owner of McGraw-Hill is Ghislaine Maxwell's dad. From elementary through high school, Maxwell's goal with McGraw-Hill was to dominate the entire U.S. education market. British government believed that Robert was part of Mossad and had him classified as a double, if not triple, agent.
He was worth $2.8 billion,
and that's all the textbooks in America.
1988, that's crazy.
And I remember McGraw-Hill.
Hey, we got one more caller in there. Jay, I'll let you go now.
Thing runs deep.
Okay, thank you, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, caller in, where are you calling from? What's your name?
This is John the Beggar from the South Shore of the St. Lawrence Seaway.
John, hi. Say hi to Lynn. And we only got a few more minutes left, guys. 10 minutes.
Okay. So. Hey, Lynn, how you doing?
Okay.
Okay. I don't think anyone died in the Manson family murders. Sarah Good was involved in it. The Good lady, a cousin probably, and her family, the Goods, go back to the Salem witch trials. I don't think that. What was that director? Roman Polanski. I don't think he molested any little girl. He went off to live in France with his wife, Sharon Tate. They had a kid there, and they raised their child. And I think the whole thing about him being a pervert and doing that is all just
Jesuit theater.
There really are perverts who do this, but I think it's another empty rabbit hole, just like the Jeffrey Epstein thing.
Okay.
Well, if someone is criminally indicted, as Polanski was, then you're saying that the court system in the United States frames people.
No, I'm saying that it's a CIA court. I don't think it's a real court. Miles Mathis did a really good story on this. And I don't think anyone was ever indicted, and I think it's all just a bunch of nonsense. I mean, these things are real, these pedophile rings, and they do blackmail and stuff, but they put stuff out there to tantalize you and titillize. And I don't think anyone died in the Manson murders at all. It's just, in fact, I knew a guy who was a cop out there. At the time, he was in Beverly Hills, and he saw Manson on TV once, and he thought, this is crazy. So he called a friend of his in the county sheriff's office, and the friend said the whole thing was just a hoax. So I don't believe any of this is real at all. I think we're going down empty rabbit holes.
Well, I'll tell you this. It's no empty rabbit hole to demonstrate that Robert Maxwell, in addition to controlling the lion's share of school textbooks in the United States.
Oh, I agree with you.
Took over publication of peer-reviewed journals.
Absolutely.
And
intelligence operation, and he brings people, I have no doubt.
So that's the publishing business right there. If you may be surprised to know that the instigator of peer review was the media tycoon Robert Maxwell. He may have actually come up with the idea of peer review to establish
that's amazing. I never heard he really was the founder of that, huh?
That's what they're saying here. In 1951, at the age of 28, this Czech emigre purchased 3/4 of Butterworth Press for about £500,000 at current value. He renamed it as Pergamon Press, which I'm very familiar with. It's a very famous publishing house. Mm-hmm. Very good publishing house, actually, with its core business in science, technology, and medicine journals, all of which instilled peer review. According to Meyer Cutts, Maxwell justifiably was one of the key figures, if not the key figure, in the rise of the contemporary science, technology, and medicine journal publishing business in the years after World War II. Maxwell's company stole a march on other publishers, and its influence was huge. By 1959, Pergamon was publishing 40 journals, surging to 150 by 1965. By 1996, 1 million peer-reviewed articles had been published. So, you know, what we're talking about here is the fabrication of virology as a pseudoscience, and of course COVID-19. We couldn't have had any of that without these same peer-reviewed journals.
Yeah.
Who probably were originally
Christian Drost from Germany.
Yeah, Robert Maxwell. So
and his other daughter, I think her name is Christine, is big into this med tech. I believe it's the what do they call that? Contact tracing right. thing that was going on during COVID. And I think she's a professor down in Texas. But yeah, like they, you know, they got a big scam going on with all this medical stuff. And yeah, peer review. I mean, it's just like, hey, I got my buddy to say this is true, so therefore it's true. You know, it's like a logical fallacy, pretty much.
Of course,
but you know, institutionalized.
Crazy too.
They all had their expensive pet projects. Like
gave you this virus. It's impossible.
Ghislaine Maxwell, one of her projects was something called Terra Mar, which I guess is the idea of floating islands in international waters that, of course, would not be subject to local or national laws pertaining to age of consent, right? Now, I don't know what the status of Little St. James Island was, because it is in the U.S. Virgin Islands, but would it have been subject to, I'm sure it would have been subject to the Mann Act, which is the white slavery, human trafficking. And that doesn't even, I don't even know if that refers to underage. That's just about transporting women
across state lines,
across state or territorial lines. Lucky yeah. Luciano was originally convicted on that count. And then during World War II, Meyer Lansky got him sprung from prison and released early and deported to Italy, where he helped the Allies allegedly plan the staging of the landing, the takeover of Sicily, with his contacts there. And we didn't even have the RICO statute back then, when Thomas Dewey convicted Charles Luciano of basically being a pimp under the Mann Act, which is about human trafficking.
Tom Jones
now with
says,
RICO.
Yeah. Tom Jones says Epstein died in 2019. Hillary's brother Tony Rodham died 2 months earlier. Some people later claimed that the timing lined up.
I think Epstein's alive. And I think he's probably living in Israel right now, because that's where he went in order to avoid facing trial back in 2008.
All right. Well, one thing for sure, the Epstein narrative just keeps on giving. It never ends. It's like Hunter Biden's laptop. It's the distraction of this presidency.
Not when we're talking about the money.
Okay.
Not when we're talking about the money laundering, the tax evasion, the bribery.
Well, they don't really talk about that. They talk
no,
about
no, that's the whole stuff. Idea. That's the... Every time you hear him referenced on liberal media, it's always sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. No, he wasn't just a sex offender. He was involved in human trafficking and in some major business deals.
Yeah. All
so
right. Let's
that's really what this is about. All the people that went into business with Jeffrey Epstein after he was already convicted.
Yeah.
After he was already convicted, I got to ask everybody out there, if a neighbor, a friend, a coworker, or a member of your family pled guilty and somehow managed to get a really neat sweetheart deal where he didn't have to hardly do any time, and where none of his co-conspirators were named, they were all protected, would you be hanging out with somebody like that? Would you be going into business with them?
No,
and contracts with them, but nope. Sure as hell, we've got Ehud Barak, all of them involved in this. So I say follow the money, and I still like the direction that Thomas Massie is taking this in. He's saying that it doesn't matter how many Senate or House hearings they have on this, unless there are criminal referrals and prosecutions of some of these big shots, it all means nothing. But I know you're all going to say that even if we got arrests, indictments, trials of Bill Gates or any of these other figures, it would all be for show. It wouldn't be real. So that takes us back to square one, doesn't it?
That's what I would say. Okay, let's we're at against the hard out. Willard, any closing comments?
I just say I agree with John and Berger. I think this is a story that's used, as Mark Devlin mentioned, music to debase our culture and debase us spiritually. And I think, Lynn, you're inadvertently playing into their hands by legitimizing it and pushing it. You know, just leave it be. I don't think the story's legit. Just not
let me ask you this. Do you think Woody Allen's movies do the same thing?
He did the same thing about his basement?
All right, wait. We got one more caller in, or I'm going to have to let you go, John.
6 seconds. Okay, good night, everyone.
Good night. Okay, caller in, where are you calling from? What's your name?
Yeah, Rick in Arizona.
Hey, Rick, you're the last caller. You just got in under the wire.
I always end up like, you get done eating at this time. I'm always, can't call in any earlier.
Okay.
A couple of comments. Maxwell made he made his first chunk of money smuggling scientific journals out of Germany after World War II. That's where his seed money came from. He made a fortune in that business. Now, what day is just Fake Nukes and Rosoli on in this during the week?
Wednesdays.
Wednesdays.
Always and, Wednesday. Yeah.
By the way, I just posted something that Jim sent me.
Okay.
On the on the camps, the German labor camps, Dachau, Buchenwald, Bergen-Belsen.
Okay.
And what was the real cause of the deaths in the camps? I posted it in the forum, in the revisionism forum under did big business support Hitler or something along those lines.
Okay.
Jim sent over a very nice piece of research, so I felt it needed to be posted. And if you want to know, whenever you see those newsreel footage of the bodies, the piles of bodies being bulldozed, what killed those people was typhus.
Right.
Not gas chambers. And there's some very credible sources in that article. I could bring it up, but
We got to go.
I'm glad that Jim is at least doing some serious research in this and not just throwing out, you know.
Okay. Question before you hang up.
Go ahead. You're breaking up, but go ahead.
Okay. Is it Bitcoin made kidnapping, you know, couldn't be any easier, right? I mean, if I kidnapped somebody,
I got to say about that in the blog.
Let me continue to answer this question, and I'll get off. Look, if I kidnap somebody and I have a Bitcoin wallet,
yeah,
and they're rich, I could just demand they pay me in Bitcoin, right? There's no money to be marked. There's no cops surveillance. There's no bag man. Isn't this kidnapping made easy now?
No, I think it can be traced even more easily.
Every transaction is public. There's no hiding the actual transaction on the blockchain.
But, by the way, that Savannah Guthrie thing, I have some comments in the replies to the Fake Nukes Phil Rizzoli the podcast the other night.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Where I compare it to the Elizabeth Smart case.
Yes, that's another type. This, let me finish with Rick, because Rick, your line is breaking up, but try and get your message out before we wrap it up.
Yeah, the question I just want you to answer is that if I kidnap somebody, and want the ransom paid into my wallet, there's no tracing it, right?
Well, yeah, it's on the blockchain. So you put the money into your wallet, then you've got to get it out if you want to buy groceries.
Is liquidity. What do I mean by liquidity? You got to be able to cash it out. And at the moment you cash it out, you'll probably have to pay taxes on it as well. You've got to be able to convert it to dollars or euros.
If you're over in Eastern Europe, it doesn't matter if you got to pay taxes, okay? I'm just saying if somebody gets kidnapped and they want the money paid in Bitcoin, you pay it in Bitcoin, they're going to get away with it.
Well, they could also pay American dollars.
They could deliver American currency on a pallet. Helicopter Ben Bernanke, that kind of thing, you know.
No money being transferred. I mean, there's no bag man. They're not marking the money. Once the money is dropped into my wallet.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's
The whole thing about laundering money is this, and this is why crime pays or doesn't.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to go liquid with it. You've got, at some point or another, you've got to be able to spend it or distribute it.
Well, you can. you can't spend Bitcoin money. I mean, it's that simple.
Only if someone's willing to take Bitcoin instead of dollars.
Yeah, but it's all tracked and traced. So I'm gonna say probably not on that. But Rick, you got to get a better phone line because I'm struggling to hear you.
Yeah, Rick thinks that Bitcoin is somehow or other perfectly private.
No, it's not private. There's other cryptos that are private, but good luck getting your hands on them.
I think Monero is private.
Monero
right?
is supposed to be as they scramble the.
By the way, do we have anything to say about the recent collapse of Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Well, it's not total, but.
Yeah, well, it's similar to everything else.
Goes up, silver, it goes down.
Gold, silver. Silver had the most dramatic one day of anything I can think of in a long time. 40-50%. Bitcoin's down. Amazon's down 10% today.
What they're really doing is destroying confidence in the dollar. That's what's really happening.
There's lots of thrashing around. It's been very busy, and I'm not making money in the last couple of days for sure. So anyway, hide your money in your mattresses, everybody. That's the only place to put it. That's my new advice. Or buy MRE, storable food. I'm just kidding.
They're getting ready. They're trying to set up an ICE detention center down the street from me.
You got to go take some video. Are you going to see me there?
I don't think they're going to be able to do it because the county council and the state are opposed.
Okay, Lucas has the last word. And Willard, thanks for calling. Go ahead, Lucas.
Hey, I don't blame you guys for being skeptical of the Epstein stuff because they do turn it into a soap opera. But all I'm saying is if they're willing to inject kids in our country with poison and, you know, hormones and abort them and all that kind of stuff, you know, who knows what they're capable of.
Anything they can get away with.
Right.
That's the whole point.
Yeah. Exactly. If they're doing that in our plain sight, you know, I'm just saying.
I just think that it's definitely a narrative device. But Lynn is more convinced it's got real ramifications. But that's what Lynn usually says. Lynn, thanks a lot for switching to Thursdays. I appreciate it. This is the end of the Fakeologist week. On the weekend, we do the Discord, shortfake.com/Discord. We had a new female participant last week from France by way of Poland. So it was very interesting last week. Interesting person. And we're out of time. Thanks, Anonymous, Till, Tom Jones. Thanks for all those regulars. Slick Rick in the chat. FEMA Region 4. Echo Charlie's out there. Buzzing Frets. Thanks, everyone, for coming by tonight. And we'll see you Sunday or wherever. And see you next time. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.